In the new book, Halfway Home, Race, Punishment, and the Afterlife of Mass Incarceration, Reuben Miller examines life after incarceration in the United States of America. He sheds light on critical elements around today's biggest headlines, investigating the societal breakdowns that occur and influence, for example, the Black Lives Matter movement and all it advocates, the ongoing controversies of voter suppression, and the overwhelming impact of COVID on those incarcerated in communities of color in the United States. Halfway Home includes research by Miller, a former chaplain at the Cook County Jail in Chicago and professor at the University of Chicago School of Social Service. We welcome Reuben Miller to the roundtable this morning. Reuben, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
What brought you to want to look at that afterlife?
You know, I was really moved by an ethical commitment when I was a bit younger. I began in 2003 as a volunteer chaplain at the Cook County Jail, just because of a religious and an ethical commitment to spend time with what, you know, our religious scripture talks about as the least of these. And so I felt compelled to go, and I went, and I spent time in the Cook County Jail at the height of mass incarceration. There were about 10,000 people in that jail at that moment. And what I noticed was not only people who looked like me, but people from, you know, I'm Black. I was born poor and Black in Chicago, in what we might call the mass incarceration generation. That's after 1972, when mass incarceration begins in earnest. And anyway, not only people who look like me, many Black people, but people from my neighborhood, you know. And so I would see people I knew, and I'd see people at the store who I spent time with while they were in the jail, because of course the jail is poor. It's the place where people cycle in and out. And I just wanted to know more about it, and so I started to study it. And I began work as a researcher in around 2008. And during my studies, my brother was incarcerated. And I was already starting this work, but it was so close to me that I had to write something about it.
One of the things that's so fascinating about the book is that you're basically making the case that if you have been incarcerated and you are then let go from a correctional facility, that you are never truly free from what you endured behind bars.
That's right. Yeah, that is the case. The people are followed once they leave jails or prisons. But they're greeted with something like 45,000 laws, policies, and administrative sanctions that bar their access to full participation in the economy, in the civic life of the city, whole categories of employment that people are barred from. You know, a good example of this is it took an amendment to allow people who had trained as a barber in the state of Illinois, where I'm from, in 2018, to allow those people to become barbers and cosmetologists, et cetera, after their release. And the problem with this, because, you know, some people will say, oh, well, you know, you do the crime, you do the time, and, you know, you should have thought about that before you went in or something like that. There are two problems with this. You know, problem one is 95% of cases are resolved through plea deals, meaning, people necessarily take a sentence for something that they almost necessarily didn't do. It's some version of something that they may have done. So getting to the truth of the crime never quite happens, not in this country. And the second problem with that is, you know, what's the purpose of all of this? You know, is the purpose to make us more safe? Is the purpose to protect us from people who harmed us? If that's the case, then locking people out of the labor market, for example, is the absolute wrong thing to do. What you do is you produce a situation where people are more prone to engage in the illicit economy, are more prone to commit crimes again, mm-hmm. because they're locked out of legitimate means to feed themselves.
I used the term a moment ago, but this idea that these are correctional facilities, and then so by name, they're going to correct your behavior. But isn't that all a farce? I mean, in the sense of that, okay, if you then say you're going to go in, you're going to do your time, and then you come out and you have been corrected, then why should you have this albatross around your neck for the rest of your life?
No, absolutely. I think this is absolutely true. If you know, the idea of a debt to society, the question might be, when is the debt paid? You know,
right.
Is the debt paid when you do time? And if that's the case, then why do we continue it? It's a wonderful question. The second thing I think to remember when we're thinking about corrections facilities that are the kinds of things that happen in American jails and prisons. 90% of the time that people spend in those jails and prisons is time just waiting around. There's no rehabilitation actually happening inside. And we know this is true because we've seen a 60% reduction in things like workforce preparation programming right. inside American jails and prisons. We've seen the complete gutting of the rehabilitative establishment. In fact, there have been studies, it's really interesting. There have been studies that show that even people who are sent to prison for things like substance use, and the judge says you must get treatment for substance use and you must get that treatment while you're inside, there's only 25% capacity to meet the needs of people who are mandated by a judge to get it. So to put that differently, of all the people who get told by a judge you must do substance abuse treatment, we only have enough slots to provide that treatment for 25% of the people who are mandated to receive it in order for them to be released at any point from jail or prison. It's pretty wild. Nothing like corrections happens inside correctional facilities.
You mentioned your research and you work, the work that you've done included a research project, which you spend 3 years engaging with men and women, I think 60 men, 30 women, who were incarcerated in Michigan and then following that in incarceration. They all have their separate issues. They all have their separate stories, but the commonalities are really stunning.
Yeah. You know, it's really, you're right. I mean, it's striking. You know, one thing that we see quite a bit is that people are worse off after they return home from prison or jail than they were when they went in. I mean, you know, they're unable to find work when they get home because of these laws and policies that prevent them from being able to do that. But then there's the story that leads them to jail or prison, which is striking. You know, when I ask people how old they were when they were first arrested, you know, I mean, I wasn't surprised because I grew up in a segregated, poor part of Chicago. So I wasn't surprised to learn this, but it's striking to hear nonetheless. You know, people are being arrested 10, 11, 14 years old on average for my group. And they have been arrested 14, 15 times on average. And these arrests, some of them were for, you know, things that kids do, you know, somebody broke a window, somebody got into a fight. And some of these were just for things that kids do, like hang out together in groups and play. You know, women had been arrested on, you know, about 10 times on average. Those arrests started when they were about 16 years old for much the same reasons. And so we see their entry into the criminal justice system, sometimes for everyday things that kids do, sometimes for crimes, sometimes for nothing, beginning early on and escalating throughout their lifetime. And the other thing that they had in common, which was I found a bit surprising, was the way that the criminal record was used against them. So I got guys who got stopped for nothing when they were 14. I've got another guy, there's a guy in the book who was arrested 14 times. He was homeless
right.
For about a decade. He was arrested 14 times. So he was eventually sentenced for a drug use charge. And what they did was they used those 14 arrests. He was arrested 14 times. I didn't say this, but for trespassing, he was homeless. He didn't have a place to stay. They used those 14 arrests for trespassing as evidence of his criminality and sentenced him to 3 years in prison for drug use. He had 3 crack rocks in his pocket, you know? And so we see this early involvement, and we see this, the use of the criminal record, the criminal record hanging over their head and being used against them to enhance their sentences, to give them more time. And it really complicates their lives when they come home.
Reuben Miller is our guest. The name of the new book is Halfway Home: Race, Punishment, and the Afterlife of Mass Incarceration. So right before we went on the air, I did a Google search and I put in 3 words: COVID, prisoners, vaccine. The news from today, these are just the headlines from today. Cuomo changes course in New York, allowing elderly inmates to receive coronavirus. We go to Louisiana, most eligible Louisiana prisoners taking COVID vaccine. In Orlando, Florida, inmates should get COVID vaccines. This is an op-ed. Florida lawyers argue lawmakers against. Prisoners in Massachusetts, they're getting their COVID-19 vaccine and reduced sentences. So just from the headlines, the subtext is, well, why, if I am not doing anything wrong and I'm on the list and I'm in phase two and I'm not going to get my shot, how come those who have violated the rules of our society and are incarcerated are getting the vaccine? My question to you, I mean, to me, it makes perfect sense as to why they would get the vaccine because they're in an institution. But my question to you is, I mean, that just, I'm stunned by looking at these headlines because the subtext is so there of, and we hear it all the time, well, why should they get something we don't?
It seems like the question is, why is this a question, right?
Well, right, exactly. Why is it a question, and why is it just the perception? Because you know the headline writers are writing it the way to piss us off.
That's
because
right.
They know it's going to get us a lot
That's
of people
right.
under their skin.
That's absolutely right, and I very much appreciate you raising that question in the way that you did, because you know, this question of who deserves what, why should lawbreakers get things that people on the outside don't give, and I'd like to give a couple answers to that. So one is, and they'll quick, one is, because prisons are porous places, that prisons aren't total institutions where people go in and nobody comes out and is sealed off hermetically from the public. So we know that prisons are always right behind nursing homes, the leading incubator of COVID, because they are and always have been the leading incubator of every kind of communicable and chronic disease. HIV prevalence is 5 times higher in prisons, 5 to 9 times. Hepatitis C, something like 9 times higher. But we also know that people who have comorbidities or pre-existing conditions, those comorbidities are often concentrated inside jails and prisons, heart disease, hypertension, you know, these sorts of things. So on the one hand, there's the humanitarian side of it, which is COVID in prisons is fatal. You can't get away. You can't social distance in a prison. Access to PPE is limited. This is a group that if COVID spreads, when COVID spreads inside prison walls, people die at greater rates than they do on the outside. On the other, it's a public health threat to everyone else because guards come inside prisons, service providers come inside jails and prisons. And if there's an outbreak inside a jail or prison, that outbreak now goes to the community of the workers who move in and out of jails and prisons. And then there's the third side of this, which is everybody's not in there for a life sentence. You know, right.
Right. So, if you get two to three, it's not a life sentence.
It's not a life sentence. Some people are in there for murder. Sure. Okay. So let's say you don't want people who are in for murder, which I think is inhumane and cruel. Even saying it makes me bristle. Let's say you don't want people who are in there for murder to have access to the vaccine. They killed somebody. They shouldn't be. Okay. What about the guy who's in there for writing a bad check?
Yeah.
You know, what about the guy who's wrongfully convicted? You know, there have been 2,800 exonerations in our country since 1989, and it takes so much to get a case appealed, reheard to the place where people have been exonerated. So it takes so much effort that it takes on average 9 years to get to the place. So people have done on average 9 years on average spending in jails or prisons for crimes they don't commit. So what about the person who's innocent? What about the person inside of jail where the charges are going to be dropped? Well, that's 2/3 of the jail population, by the way. I mean, we're talking about prisons, but jails also are incubators of COVID. 2/3 of the jail population will never have a charge filed against them. So the problem is the conflation of criminality with the population in prison. And the problem is the overwhelming lack of compassion that we have for this group. But yeah. Even if you don't have compassion for this group, at the very least, we should think about our linked fates. The fact that if there's an outbreak in a jail or prison, there's going to be an outbreak in all the towns surrounding it in about 5 minutes.
You look at the policies that we have set up, and they're just inhumane. I can't tell you how many times in reading this book, I just thought to myself, well, it makes no sense.
Yeah.
One of the examples being that, okay, we're going to let you out and we're not going to help you really in any way, shape or form. But if you can't get your act together and you become homeless, that's a violation of your parole. We'll figure
that out. That's right. That's right. It's really interesting. You know, this is a part of a general, like a deep commitment to individuality that I think we cherish as Americans, which is very important. You know, that we have a sense, an individual sense of self-worth and this kind of thing. But we also tend to attribute every negative thing that happens to someone to something that they specifically did.
Right.
And then we end up missing the components that are in place that allow people to thrive or not. So this is even a question of privilege or racism or any of the absolutely all these things matter. I don't want to discount that. All these things matter, but I'm saying in this instance, this thing we're talking about right now, you don't even have to be living in a racist society or in a privileged society or something like that to see the sense of this. And the sense is this: if landlords have the constitutional right to reject your application, and if landlords who provide you with access to a house, to housing, can be sued if you break a law on those premises. That was a series of legislations that got passed and, you know, beginning in the 1980 and culminating in 1996 that said landlords could be sued for providing a criminogenic environment, which included housing people with records. It's really wild. If that's the case, this suggests you can't get a place to stay. It's almost impossible for you to get a place to stay on your own. If I now make not having a place to stay a violation of your probation or parole, I should be unsurprised that something like a quarter of all prison admissions in a given year are for violations of probation and parole just like this. This is a cycle that we produce. We make this. We can unmake this.
You write in the book, of the 2.3 million people who are incarcerated, 40% are Black, 84% are poor, and half have no income at all, making it clear to anyone paying attention that the legal system does not administer anything resembling justice, but instead manages the nation's problemed populations. Talk a little bit about that, and what one of your conclusions of the book is that the problem of mass incarceration is really a problem of citizenship.
Yeah, thank you for that. You know, this hinges on an examination of what citizenship is in my mind, and also in the minds of scholars who study it, including me, of course. But citizenship, at the end of the day, is political belonging, and belonging is about belonging to a community, of having a place in a community, having a role in a society, and being able to play it in many ways unencumbered from the violence of discrimination, from the violence of others who don't want to see you play a role, who try to hinder your role. Citizenship is about belonging. Okay, well, what we see when we look inside American jails and prisons we see many groups of people who we just have tried to throw away for centuries. So we see the overwhelming representation of Black people in American jails and prisons. This is why we call mass incarceration mass. It has to do with the number of poor, largely uneducated or undereducated Black men that have been just arrested at egregious rates. Now, it's not just education and poverty, though. You know, recent economic studies tell us that a white male from a white family that makes something like $34,000 a year has the same chance of going to jail or prison as a Black man from a house that makes $1 million or more. So we see that there's a racial element here that gets beyond the economics of it. Having said that, there's something like 1 million poor white men in jails and prisons in this country. So 40% of the prison is Black, 40% of the prison is white. What does it mean to live in a country where there are 2 million prisoners? If we released every Black prisoner today, we would still have one of the largest prisons in the world. What does that tell us about us? What does it mean to live in a country that operates under, I think racism is real. I think that's clear. I think it's clear when you look at the statistics. Black people are 5 times more likely to be arrested than whites. But what does it mean to live in a country that operates under this kind of, like, that has a problem with systemic racism, that is borne out empirically? There's many studies that reveal its many problems, and yet, and still, 1 in 8 white women has a currently incarcerated loved one. And what does it mean to live in that same country, and for everyone in that country to think that mass incarceration is a Black problem? Mass incarceration is an American problem. It doesn't stop at the threshold of the Black family. It involves us all. But because of how race and racism works, we don't care.
Right.
We don't care because we think it's the video guy. It's the hoodlum who you know this figure of Black. It's Willie Horton. This is the problem. But no, it's not just Willie Horton. It's the fact that it's not just poor Black Americans, even though we're disproportionately arrested and incarcerated. And this is a racist issue. There's a problem here. But while so many Black people are being fed to this machinery, so too are so many poor white men. You know, there was a recent study in 2016 that showed that while 49% of Black men will be arrested by the time they turn 23 for a non-traffic violation, so will 38% of young white men. They will be arrested in this country by the time they turn 23, not for a traffic stop. We have a problem with punishment on top of our problems with racism, with classism, with the way we think about gender disparities in this country, right? But those things, the animus that we have toward each other doesn't allow us to see the harm that we do to ourselves. This, I think, is one of the deeper points of this book.
Well, and you just made this point, but I mean, and the afterlife is so much different between a white and a Black person after they get out for whatever it is that they've done.
No, this is true. This is absolutely true, because of the cultural stuff. So because Black people are viewed as more guilty, the social psychology studies have shown this, that Black boys, for example, are viewed as older and more guilty, 4 years older on average, than white boys of the same age. And when I say boy, I mean boy. We're talking about children.
Right.
Of the same age. So that's absolutely true. I think the point that I'm trying to make right now is that it hurts us all. You know, the problems are concentrated within Black and then brown communities. It certainly concentrated along the lines of poverty. So we see race and poverty at work here in the egregious disparities that we're now living through in relation to the criminal justice system and all other systems, all other American social systems for sure. But it hurts us all. It hurts us all. The mass incarceration doesn't stop at the threshold of the Black family. White children are being swallowed up and eaten alive by this same system, though their outcomes are better. Though they have better outcomes, are these the outcomes that we want for our children, for any of them? This is the question of the book. If mass incarceration is about citizenship and citizenship is about belonging, I think the action that we have to take is an action of reimagination. Might we rethink how society might function were we to find a place even for people we're afraid of? I think that's the important work for us to be doing right now.
So Ruben, let's end with this, and that's with the title of the book, Halfway Home. What do you mean by that?
Well, there's kind of a double meaning. On the one hand, you know, I spent a lot of time in halfway houses.
Yep.
You know, so in Chicago, I spent about 3.5 years doing ethnography, which is participant observation, meaning I do what people do when they're in the place. And so I went to treatment, with people who were going to treatment. I took the classes they took, and I spent most days for about 3.5 years in halfway houses in the city. But on the one hand, I was trying to honor, that experience, but on the other hand, it's about being stuck. It's about never quite making it home. Home being this elusive place because we can't figure a way for people to belong, which is why the book ends on this point that I've been sort of returning to a few times, which is if mass incarceration is a problem of citizenship and citizenship is about belonging, perhaps the work that we might do would be about constructing a world in which people who have harmed us even have a place. I think this is a very important thing for us to do. I want to see people make it home, even people who've made mistakes.
Ruben Miller is a former chaplain at the Cook County Jail in Chicago. He is professor at the University of Chicago School of Social Service and author of the new book, Halfway Home, Race, Punishment, and the Afterlife of mass incarceration. Reuben Miller, a great pleasure to have you on the program. I thank you very much for bringing these issues to light and discussing them with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
A great pleasure. Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is Halfway Home. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.